Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, last week, Faraz and I had a very interesting chat about the formation of civilization. And when it comes time to look at the layers that Christianity builds on that, or what Christianity builds around that, Carl has some strong opinions because it includes the desert people, who, of course, he identifies with often. So, Carl.
No, I don't. I like the pre-Islamic Middle East because it's so alien. Right. It's such a different civilization to anything that we have had in our history that it is fascinating and it's just completely strange.
Well, I'll set the argument, and we're joined by Faraz, of course. So thank you very much, Faraz. So I'll set the argument. What I'm basically saying is I'm looking at religion as a civilizational technology. And what is special about Christianity is it adds something every environment that it moves through. Mm-hmm. And essentially what I'm saying is, and we've got a mix here, somebody who isn't particularly religious, somebody who is trying to be religious, and somebody who actually is religious. Mm-hmm. I'm not actually going after the religious angle on this.
I'm not trying to be religious either.
Aren't you going to church?
Yeah, but that's because I have to, not because because I think it's good for the kids, and my wife wants to go. I'm not religious.
There must be some sense of trying to engender a bit of religiosity somewhere.
I just don't feel it.
Oh, okay. Well, that's kind of where I am.
Yeah. It's not a feeling. Yeah. It's an act of will. Slight difference.
Anyway, so what I'm saying is that what I think religion really is, aside from the moral stuff, which we won't get into on this occasion, it is a civilizational technology for lowering the cost of governance by making enforcement cheaper.
Well, I mean, that's what Christianity is.
Yes.
But religion has different forms in different areas, right? Hmm. So Aztec religion was not that.
That's fair. That's fair. I am focusing on
ancient
Christianity.
Middle Eastern religion was not that.
Yes.
You know, it was designed to bind a group together in order to enforce dominance over other groups. Right. So and the thing about Christianity is it's really peculiar. I mean, there was a statement from Avi Yemeni the other day where he was like, because Epstein had been using the word Goyim, and he's like, "Dear Goyim, we love you unless you hate us." And it's like, well, there we go, right?
That's kind of exactly. The point.
Yeah. I mean, literally everyone is the same in that, right? You know, yes. I like that person unless they hate me, and then why would I like that person, right? But Christianity is really unique in the love thy enemy, because a Christian can't say that, right?
A non-Christian.
No. Sorry?
A non-Christian can't say that.
Well, no, a Christian can't say, we love you unless you hate us.
Oh, yes.
Right. So a Christian has to say, no, we love you. Our love is universal.
Yes.
And we will, you know, forgive you, turn the other cheek, whatever it is that the Christian wants to do in the face of the insult. So Christianity is actually really unusual in the scheme of West, like the religions of the West, because it has such a different perspective on what it is to be moral. Right. In every way, for Christianity, being moral is something transcendent. Right? It's something that happens. I mean, all of Christianity's promises are in the afterlife. Right? They're all in the next life. Mm-hmm. Whereas pagan religions promise glory and victory now. Right? They're very much in the here and
yes,
now.
Yes, defeat your enemies this afternoon.
As does Islam. As does Judaism.
Exactly. Islam and Judaism follow the same moral structure as the pagan religions. I mean, like in Judaism. It is a pagan Middle Eastern religion. It's just that the Middle East was usually, I mean, an early Judaism is very much henotheistic, right? As in, it only worships one God, but it does concede other gods exist. And early Judaism has this in its own DNA. And it's only later on in the development of Judaism, probably like 400 BC or something like that, that it actually becomes monotheistic.
Yeah,
where it's like, where it denies the existence of other gods.
Right. So from the Christian perspective, Judaism recognizes the presence of other powers, as does Christianity. Other nations call them gods. The way that Judaism operated was to recognize that reality and then slowly purify its monotheism.
Yes.
And it was a gradual process because in the Christian worldview, most peoples and most religions have grains of truth in them that should be developed and nourished where they are found. However, it is only Christianity that contains the fullness of truth. So that's the view of Christianity on this question.
So okay. the point...
Go on.
Well, the point I was going to make is basically that the reason that the Middle Eastern religions that are not... Like, Christianity is a very European religion, right? I don't think it's a coincidence that it is the product of European occupation for hundreds of years of the area of the Near East that it came from that gave it the form that it has. Sorry to not imply that it's the divine revelation or anything, but from a philosophical perspective, it's stamped with European ideas all over it, whereas Judaism and Islam are not. They're very parochial, particular, and
tribal.
And this just follows the ancient tribal pattern of Middle Eastern religiosity, which is this is our tribe's god. Our tribe. It took a long time for syncretism to emerge in the Middle East, right? So it would, back 5,000 BC, each tribe had essentially its god, and it was understood that there'd be other powers in the world, and these belonged to other tribes. And eventually you end up with a pantheon of gods that each city in...
they conquered a city, they might not get rid of the god, but they would subordinate.
It's not even that they
god.
Conquer them, because it used to just be that the god lived at the top of the temple in the statue of the city, right? And it's not that the god was trapped in the statue. It would just, when you are... The thing is, monotheistic religions don't give the pagan theology a fair shrift, which I'm not pointing fingers. It's understandable why they wouldn't, right? In the same way that, I don't tend to give communists a fair shrift on their ideology. But the pagans viewed the statue as being a sort of temporary seat of the god. So when you perform a ritual, the god will come and sit in the statue and actually be present, manifested in the statue. So it's not that the idol itself was worshipped. It's the idol was just a part of the religious process. The god existed outside of the idol. But the god resides when interfaced with at the top of the temple in the city. So the capturing of other gods' statues, which is what happened all the time, when you conquered a city, the Assyrians had dozens of statues of other gods in the great temple at Asher, right? Because the great god Asher would conquer every city, and they would just loot their statues, parade them through the streets, and then lay them face down at the feet of Asher. Depending on how many the king had conquered, you get, how many.
So two points relating to that note. The first point is the way that essentially after the Exodus and the reign of King David, the Hebrew God got his own house in the temple.
Yes.
And he says to King David, no, I don't need that. I don't want that. And when I will bestow that honor of building me a temple on your son Solomon. With Islam, the Kaaba, where the Muslims go for their pilgrimage, used to be the home of a bunch of Arab tribal gods. And Muhammad goes in and destroys the other idols, saying that he did what Abraham did, which I think is in some version of the Jewish Mishnah or something like that, where there's a story about Abraham destroying the other gods. So there is this evolution of religious thought. But going to your point on religion as a social technology, yes, to a certain extent. The other side of it is that you will never find a people anywhere, even at the most primitive state, without some sense of the metaphysical.
Mm.
So it's not just a technology, it's a naturally emergent property of human beings.
Yes.
And it distinguishes human beings from other species.
Just on that point, though, you could still frame it as a technology. Because
you could.
What you are absolutely correct, obviously. As far back as we have any records for, cave drawings on a wall, there's a metaphysical element that is attached to everything in the world, right? Mm-hmm. So we have animistic beliefs where the river is a spirit and the trees have spirits. But what these do in a technological way is give the people a kind of respect and awe for the world around them. As in that sort of primitive condition, the world's a very dangerous place. Right, you can't just mess around in the river. There might be a crocodile in there, or the current might drag you off or something. You have to treat the thing with respect, and to show respect for the natural world is the first way to not get killed or eaten by it, right? And so it's it still has a technological aspect, even though it, of course, is entirely moral.
Well, should I run through very quickly what the argument is with the diagram that I'm going through, and then you can sort of...
Sorry, just one more point about that. This is where we get to a fundamental disagreement, which is fine to have, obviously, which is whether or not this is a purely material question. So
I'm not saying it's a purely material question.
Okay. But to elaborate very briefly, the disagreement is that, is this merely necessary for survival, or does this reflect something that is within us, namely, to give it a religious name, a soul?
I mean, I would say it's both things, right?
Fair enough.
So whether...
You believe that human beings have souls.
Well, whether it doesn't matter what the actual reality of the thing is, right? What kind of matters in this regard is what we believe is the case and how we act. Mm. And even the most ardent materialist acts as if every human being has a soul, right? Notice how, you know, they're like, oh, you know, we're just a floating ball of dust in the middle of space, but don't you dare say something racist.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Like they all act as if, you know, I mean, if you're a genuine materialist, what's stopping you from acting like an Assyrian warlord? Like, what's seriously, if there's no moral consequence in the afterlife, why do you care?
Exactly.
No, I'm just going to enslave the neighboring tribe.
If you commit a crime and get away with it, kill somebody, why
exactly.
not?
Exactly. Like, yes. But they don't act like this because they don't really believe it. Well, they do think that there is a moral telos to the universe, and it is about respecting the soul of the individual, even if they wouldn't use that
word. I'm not questioning the soul aspect.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just not considering it at this time. I'm just looking at it as a civilizational technology. Yes, yes, yes. What does it add to civilization? And my argument is basically, without any religion, your method of conflict resolution is going to be two guys who have a disagreement go at it. Maybe one loses and one dies.
You can resolve that
with religion. You have that.
You know, but my point is that is an extremely expensive form of order because you lose people as you go.
Hmm.
When you get to the desert layer, where I'm kind of starting my analysis of Christianity, at that layer, you're bringing in presumably a king or something like that, a tribal chief, who's saying, I have the approval of the gods. This is the law. Here it is on the tablets. Don't do anything to your neighbor's goat or kill their son or whatever it is. And if you do, there is going to be a messy, painful public execution at this level.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is trying to minimize the conflict by saying, these are the rules, and if you break them, you will die,
mm-hmm.
which is not actually trying to get to sacrifice people. What it's trying to do is stop them from doing the crime in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all originating from one man. That's the desert land. When you move up to the Mediterranean, this is where Christianity meets the Greeks and the Romans and the legalistic system. And they're more oligarch type system. And it ceases being so much about the one individual who's laying down the law. Now it's God is guiding us to discover the laws. We're going to lay them out. It's going to become much more procedural. It's going to become much more ritualistic. And we're basically adding legitimacy of this layer.
Mm-hmm.
But we're spreading it across, because we're adding that legitimacy layer, we're adding the systematic layer to it. We are then adding process to this, which again makes conflict resolution less expensive. And then the Great Revolution was the Northern European layer, because at this point, what you're saying is you're getting everybody to internalize it. And you're saying that everybody has to be moral within themselves, which is the least expensive enforcement, because people don't want to commit the crimes in the first place.
So can I give my view of this?
Yes.
So I think that you are right to identify three different layers. And I think the difference is the philosophical groundwork of them. So the desert layer is entirely based on an argument from authority, right?
Yes.
Because when you say king, like every Middle Eastern lawgiver is essentially a prophet, right? Like Hammurabi or Ur-Nammu, like going back to literally the very oldest codes of law, something like 2400 BC, the Code of Ur-Nammu. Begins with the great god Utu empowered me to provide his divine providence across the land, and therefore here are 10 laws. It's not even 10 laws, it's actually really short. But then you get to Hammurabi, he's like, right, well, I've got 33 laws for you. Now, you know, the great god Shamash has informed me that these are the laws, and I have to impose these on a benighted and blighted land full of criminals, evildoers, lawbreakers, scum of the earth. And then you get Moses. Well, here are the Ten Commandments, straight from God. You've got to do it because otherwise we're fucked. And then you get essentially the Quran, which is the product of this, which is just a really, really developed version of this code of laws.
It's a massive codex. Don't do this.
But this is just in the process of standard Middle Eastern religious development, because it begins with only a handful of laws and it ends. I mean, there's the Assyrian, Middle Assyrian code of laws, which is hundreds of pages of divine commandments from Asher, which are just don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other, and this is the punishment of this. And it's all exactly this way. And you've got hundreds of pages, and then you've got essentially, you know, however long the Quran is, where it's just you, when you sit there and say these are the rules and you have to follow them, well, you have to account for every eventuality. Yes. Right. And so the book of rules just keeps getting longer and longer and longer and longer until you've literally encompassed everything a human being can do.
But that lets you scale up, because that pushes down the amount of violence and the amount of waste in the society.
No, that increases the amount of violence, right? Because this is entirely predicated on an argument from authority. At some point in history, someone with sufficient political power imposed this on the civilization. It's not necessarily the way they'd normally live. In fact, many of the times it's directly contradictory to how they are actually living. Right, and Muhammad is a great example of this, right? And Moses is a great example of this as well, right? The Israelites are not doing as they're supposed to be doing, as according to God's own divine plan. Muhammad sees the same with the Arabs. He's like, right, no, and I'm going to impose this through war, right? War on Canaan, war on the Arabs, war on the whatever tribe, you know, the Babylonians are fighting with or the Assyrians are fighting with, right? It's directly imposed hierarchically, top down, because the only legitimacy from it is pure authority. The authority of the God and the force the God has imbued in me.
Yes.
And this is the argument. They always preface their laws by saying the great God X has empowered me to beat the crap out of everyone.
Yes.
This is a fundamental difference with Christianity.
Yes. Because can I get to that in a minute? Let me lay out the three lists, because I'll show you why I think Christianity is different. So what this means, there are advantages to the desert layer, right? It centralizes power. And that means that power can be wielded very effectively and quickly. There's just one guy. And because it is the God that is empowering him, there's literally no one to appeal to other than the
scale is difficult under that model.
Scale is very difficult. And this is what the Assyrians found, right? So the Assyrians created what is probably the largest empire you can create under this model, where it's the king of Assyria is like the king of kings, like with the Persian Empire, right? Like he doesn't actually, I mean, it is the case that they did actually incorporate provinces and put governors in. But most of the time, for most of Assyria's history, the king of Assyria would just have the biggest and best army. Mm. And therefore, that meant his god was the most strong. And so he'd go over to this kingdom or this city or whatever, kick the living daylights out of them, and their king would supplicate himself. I mean, there's one of the earliest references of the Israelites is them supplicating themselves to the king of Assyria, where the Israelite king is literally bowing down and kissing the feet of the Assyrian king because he's got the most powerful god. And so what that means is yearly tribute. And this is one of the reasons that you've got like Sennacherib's assault on Judea, because Hezekiah decides, you know, I just don't feel like paying my tribute. It's like, okay, that's mental, because you are a tiny backwater kingdom and the king of Assyria can field 250,000 men and they're professionals. So... what are you doing? You know, and anyway.
And if the king of Syria says he wants Greenland, you have to give it to him.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he will put up stele saying, oh yeah, I climbed these mountains, destroyed these people. I climbed this. I traversed these deserts, destroyed these. That's all he does.
Hmm.
So, and that's all his ancestors have ever done. Right. And so it gives you a very strong core of power, and it legitimizes basically anything the king does. So it's a very useful thing if you're in a very competitive, disparate environment where you've got lots of different tribes, lots of different people, and you need security, right? Yeah, no, we're just going to build the biggest goddamn army and smash the crap out of everyone around us. Now, in the Bible, there's some honestly justly earned references to Assyria.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Assyria, no one will lament when you fall. And nobody did lament when they fell, because eventually you make so many enemies that they all just realize, do we all hate the Assyrians, do we? Okay, let's crack on, right? And this is how the Assyrians end up falling as a massive coalition of people, sack their cities, essentially erase them. There are still Assyrians in existence, but there's something like 4 million of them in the entire world after 2,500-3,000 years after the original extermination of the Assyrians.
So it makes them strong but brittle by relying on just this one innovation. It makes them
powerful but brittle, yeah. And it doesn't scale, like you said, because one of the problems that the Assyrians had is that essentially they've been campaigning all across the known world, and they're 1,000 miles away from where their cities are. Mm. And it's just like, guys, I think now's the time. Mm. You know, I don't think they can get back. And this, yeah, it's a longer story than that, but that's the summary of it. And then you get the Mediterranean there. So that's built on a different moral justification. Because, okay, the great god Asher is only great while his army is present and beating the crap out of people. Mm. If it ever loses, then the great god Asher falls and topples and he's gone forever. But with the Mediterranean layer, that's not how they organized themselves. So what they had was rationalism. So it was incredibly common, especially for the Greeks, but also elsewhere in like Italy and the Etruscans and things like that, for them to send a philosopher to another city who would literally say, these are the laws. And they would choose this guy from some other city because, and it's the same thing in the same way that the sort of Europeans would choose a new king from overseas because he doesn't have personal investments here. Like there's a particular story of like the Russian principality in the Middle Ages who literally couldn't decide on who the prince was going to be. So they just import some random foreign prince because you can't choose one from among you because you're like, oh, right, we're going to lose out.
William of Orange.
William of Orange is a great example of this, right? If we choose a guy from that tribe or that team over there in the city we're living in, well, he's just going to privilege his friends and family. We're going to lose out. We can't have that. And they're like, well, the same for the other way. So you have to choose someone else. Now, there are loads of examples of this, of people like Solon, Draco. Plato went over to Syracuse to try and give, was it Hiero? Or I can't remember which one it was. That whatever the Syracusan title is, a set of laws. But the thing is, Syracuse is a bit of a strange entity. So Plato came back going, no, that was a mistake. These people are idiots. But the point is, it was really common for you get some distinguished gentleman philosopher to come over and give you a rational settlement, right? Here are your laws. And so the laws the Greeks always used had this kind of universal tinge to them, right? Because it was egoistic. It was like an individual, like the rational European philosophy is, and you can see it in Aristotle to this day, what does the individual man do? Well, if the individual man does X, then that's every man who can do X. And this is why Christianity takes on a very different tone to other Middle Eastern religions, because they're universal, right? The instructions Moses gives to the Israelites are not for the Gentiles. They're not for the foreign. They're for the Israelites to maintain mm-hmm. this. This is the covenant that God has with the Israelites. It's particular. It's only for these people. Who cares about the rest?
And this is the same as Hammurabi's 33 laws or whatever.
Hammurabi's.
Hammurabi, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Hammurabi is different.
But Hammurabi, for him, it's whoever he controls as the king.
Well, isn't that the same for Moses?
No, Moses specifically stipulates the Israelites. But for Hammurabi,
the laws for the Gentiles under the Jews are different from the laws for the Jews themselves.
And it's the same in Islam, which is why you have to pay the jizya.
Same for Islam, because it's understood that this is a law for a particular nation.
Hmm.
So in the same way the Jews view themselves as a nation, Islam views itself as an ummah.
So you're saying
about a single nation of nations, in a sense.
Yes. So you're saying that Christianity was universal even at the desert layer?
No, because the desert layer of Christianity is Judaism.
Okay.
So the Mediterranean layer, the Greek layer, begins in a rational animal, as in the Aristotelian conception. Aristotle didn't impose this on the Greeks. This is just the way the Greeks thought. Right? What does a rational animal do? A rational man makes decisions, right? And so you get this very rationalistic, individualistic perspective on morality that comes from the Greeks. And so what you need are justifications. You need moral, rational justifications. And this is what essentially Greek philosophy is, to explain why we should be good people. And you end up in a kind of Kantian categorical imperative when you go down that line, right? Any rational person should be able to understand the argument made for the moral position that you're in. And therefore, there's no particularity that's baked in to the moral philosophy itself. Anyone can pick up Stoicism. Anyone can pick up Epicureanism. Right, anyone can pick up any of these things and just live by these precepts. You know, Aristotelianism. You know, I'm not Greek, but I think Aristotle's.
But at the Mediterranean level, they're still dealing with Mediterranean people, and so there's still going to be lots of sin. So you're going to need a mechanism for dealing with sin.
Well, no, sin and crime are different.
Yeah, sin kind of is not really something they thought about.
Yes, I suppose that is a later.
I guess Plato had some conception of it. but a very possibly undeveloped one.
But how widespread would that have actually been in the
country? I guess what I'm getting at is the contrast with the layer above it, the European level, where everybody's sort of internalizing.
I'll get to this in a minute. Right. So the point is, the Mediterranean layer is expressly rationalistic, right? You get codes of laws that are imposed, but they're imposed because of a person who is not necessarily appealing to a god, but is appealing to what would be good for a particular consequence. They are making a logical argument. And a great example of this is Lycurgus, right? Lycurgus wants to essentially impose a socialist republic on Sparta because he realizes that they will always need 10,000 professional trained soldiers to be able to defend the Peloponnese. And this means that he needs to impose a particular order on it. And so it is literally, it looks like an American city. You know, American cities, very rationally constructed. Well, he literally grids up Sparta and parcels out the land to a soldier. And that soldier has an assigned number of helots, which are Greek slaves that are from a neighboring city they've conquered, to work the land. And the soldier is forbidden from working the land, but he has to contribute to a shared mess. And therefore, it essentially turns into a kind of militaristic socialist experiment. And then Lycurgus, after instituting this, goes to the Oracle of Delphi, and he asks the Oracle, is this a good order and will it preserve Sparta? And the Oracle says, yes, on the condition that basically, as long as they hold your laws, Sparta will be fine. And so Lycurgus is like, right, okay, well, I told them, hold the laws until I come back and see how they work. And so he realizes he can't go back if he wants them to do this thing in perpetuity. So he has to wander off into the desert and starve himself to death, right? And that's the end. But Lycurgus noticed it went the other way. He had the idea. He was like, right, okay, if we just do this, then Sparta's great. I'm going to get the sanction of the god afterwards. God didn't tell me to do this.
Yes.
I just made sure the god thinks this is a good idea. And so you've inverted this now, right? So the source of it is the human mind, and it's sanctioned by the god. So it's not just an appeal to authority. It's an appeal to reason that is the layer the Greeks operated on, right? And so that's the layer in which Christianity comes out of this. Right, because Christianity does have the shape of Greek thought in it, which is fine, and which is probably why it spread so wildly, because it's just intuitive, right? Like everyone agrees, yeah, no, actually, you know, I am a decision-making person, and therefore, as a rational human being, I can reason into the position that I'm in.
If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all, and you get loads of really good content.